Nemoto presents addiction. Why this person? Why this drug? Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 30 minutes. Addiction can be described most accurately as a human condition rather than as a property of a drug. The drugs and behaviors that become objects of compulsion are diverse, yet the underlying pattern remains recognizable across contexts and eras. Individuals encounter pain, stress, or emptiness. A substance or behavior offers immediate relief. Repetition teaches the nervous system and the person's routines to expect that relief. Alternatives atrophy. The relief narrows into necessity, and the necessity eventually imposes costs that exceed the original pain. The pharmacology matters because some substances carry higher risk and faster escalation, and some behaviors present subtler pathways. Yet the center of gravity remains human. Attachment and loss, safety and fear, loneliness and belonging, purpose and futility, agency and defeat. A policy or a clinical method that treats the drug as the full explanation misses the conditions into which the drug arrives and the functions it ends up serving. This framing clarifies why different people exposed to the same substance travel different paths. Two individuals can receive identical prescriptions or encounter the same street supply, and only one develops a chronic pattern. The difference rarely lies in willpower alone. It lies in histories of caregiving, exposure to trauma, current stressors, social supports, economic stability, the availability of alternatives that provide meaning, and the presence of mental health conditions that amplify distress. Neurobiology provides the interface where these forces register. Reward circuits adapt, executive functions strain, and stress systems sensitize. But those adaptations are downstream of life circumstances. Treating the neurobiology without addressing context resembles bailing water without repairing the hull. The language of human condition is not abstraction. It is a reminder to measure what matters. Outcomes should be defined beyond abstinence. Survival, housing stability, employment or schooling, restored family roles, reduced emergency utilization, control of infections, improvements in mood and sleep, and the gradual return of ordinary pleasures. Programs that pursue these outcomes behave differently. They organize around continuity rather than spectacle, around retention rather than quick discharges, and around practical support rather than moral theater. When metrics are aligned with human reality, budgets and schedules follow, and staff understand what success looks like in daily work. If addiction is a human condition, then pain in its many forms stands near the origin of most cases. Pain can be physical and visible, such as postoperative discomfort or chronic injury, and pain can be psychological and invisible, such as the residue of humiliation, grief, or fear. Early caregiving that is unpredictable or terrifying teaches vigilance rather than rest, and vigilance is exhausting. Later, living with hunger, precarious housing, unsafe relationships, or isolation adds chronic strain. A substance or behavior that reliably alters state under these conditions becomes a tool. The tool may be crude and harmful, but it works in the short term. The learning that follows is simple. When distress rises, the tool is applied. The more often the tool is used, the more compelling it becomes, and the less practice the person has with alternatives. Attachment and development influence vulnerability long before any drug is involved. Caregivers who respond consistently to distress teach a child that states of fear or sadness can be named and made tolerable. Caregivers who respond sporadically or violently teach dissociation, suppression, or hypervigilance. Those strategies preserve safety in dangerous environments, but make later intimacy and regulation difficult. In adolescence, when reward sensitivity is high and social belonging is paramount, substances and risk behaviors offer shortcuts to feelings of competence or connection. Early exposure intersects with developmental plasticity. Interventions that teach labeling of emotion, distress tolerance, and conflict resolution reduce later risk because they build the very capacities that compulsive behaviors try to simulate. The void that many clinicians describe is not a romantic idea. It is a practical inventory of absences. Absence of predictable safety, absence of reliable affection, absence of fair feedback, absence of attainable goals, and absence of a believable future. Where those absences collect, the probability of compulsive relief-seeking grows. The void also appears in adulthood when identity collapses after job loss, injury, divorce, or bereavement. A person who once derived purpose from work or caregiving can find that purpose erased quickly, with nothing ready to replace it. In such periods, substances and behaviors that compress time and overpower ruminative thought become attractive. Understanding addiction as a human condition means mapping these absences and building replacements that are not fragile or performative. Social context is often decisive. Neighborhoods without living wage work, with poor transit, with unsafe streets, and with long waits for medical care are neighborhoods in which despair accumulates. Hospitals can offer detoxification and clinics can prescribe medications, but without housing and income, the conditions that fed the cycle remain intact. Conversely, where housing is secured, where transit makes clinics reachable, where employers partner with treatment programs, and where childcare is available, the same clinical methods produce stronger outcomes. The substance did not change, the ecosystem did. Systems that ignore the ecosystem produce short-term gains and long-term churn. The disease model of addiction brought useful precision by highlighting neuroadaptation, genetics, and relapse risk, but it sometimes encouraged a reductive view that treated the brain as the only theater. A more complete model preserves neurobiology while placing it among other determinants. The nervous system is not a free-floating organ. It is conditioned by the environment and by the narratives that environment supplies. When a clinic says, "Return if a lapse occurs," it embeds a useful narrative about error and repair. When a court says any lapse equals failure, it embeds a harmful narrative that turns a predictable event into catastrophe. The brain learns from both molecules and meanings. The latter travel through policy as well as through conversation. Stigma persists because it reduces complexity into a single trait and transforms that trait into a verdict. Labels like junkie, crackhead, or drunk compress biographies into insults. Stigma serves a political function by locating the problem in the individual, absolving institutions of responsibility to repair conditions that contribute to addiction. Reframing addiction as a human condition returns responsibility to shared spaces, schools, clinics, courts, shelters, employers, newsrooms, and budgets. That reframing does not eliminate personal accountability, it rebalances it. Individuals remain responsible for behavior. Institutions remain responsible for design. Recovery in this frame looks less like a single conversion and more like gradual competence. Competence is built through repetition of small, durable actions, attending appointments, taking medication, preparing meals, maintaining sleep routines, practicing de-escalation in family conversations, keeping work or study commitments, and repairing promptly after harm. Programs that promote competence do not rely on inspiration. They rely on schedules that match dosing windows, transportation that removes a practical barrier, and staffing that persists through ambivalence. Motivation matters, but availability and reliability matter as much. Calls answered on the first ring accomplish more than slogans pinned to a wall. Families experience addiction as rearranged roles. One member assumes enforcement. Another becomes a rescuer. A third withdraws. A fourth becomes a scapegoat. These roles stabilize daily life without solving underlying problems, and they often persist even after the person with addiction begins to change. Family therapy, when it avoids blame and focuses on structure, can reassign tasks, teach clear boundaries, and make relapse planning explicit. Families equipped with scripts for boundary setting, overdose response, and de-escalation contribute to stability rather than to cycles of crisis and repair. A human condition lens validates that families require training and relief, not only exhortation. the workplace can undermine or support recovery. Immediate termination for disclosure drives problems underground. Policies that allow confidential reporting, medical leave, and guided return to work transform potential catastrophes into manageable events. Supervisors train to recognize withdrawal or sedation and to respond with referral rather than humiliation protect colleagues and retain employees whose skills would otherwise be lost. Employers benefit from stability. Employees benefit from dignity. Communities benefit from both. Again, the drug did not change. The design did. Justice systems have played contradictory roles, often punishing addiction as misbehavior while expecting different outcomes. When possession for personal use is treated as a criminal offense, the result is usually churn without improvement, fines that cannot be paid, warrants for missed court dates, employment lost to court appearances, and housing lost to incarceration. When justice systems redirect eligible cases to treatment and ensure that medications are available during custody with immediate continuation upon release, outcomes improve. A human condition framework recognizes the difference between violent trafficking and survival behaviors and allocates enforcement accordingly. Safety is preserved by focusing on violence and exploitation. Health is preserved by integrating care. Clinical practice anchored in this view adopts several habits. It treats ambivalence as normal and works with it rather than against it. It sets functional goals jointly with the patient, measuring sleep, work or school attendance, and relationship stability alongside use. It offers medications for opioid and alcohol use disorder without moral commentary, recognizing them as tools that stabilize the nervous system so that other work can proceed. It integrates screening for depression, anxiety, trauma, HIV, and hepatitis. It uses low-dose induction for buprenorphine, where high-potency opioids dominate supply, and it plans methadone access, where indicated. It maintains continuity after hospitalization, after arrest, and after residential stays. It recognizes relapse as information and resumes the plan rather than restarting the story at zero. Education systems carry responsibility beyond messaging campaigns. Curricula that include emotion regulation, media literacy, sleep hygiene, and peer influence navigation reduce vulnerability. Programs that teach overdose recognition, the risks of counterfeit pills, and the steps for obtaining help create practical competence. The goal is not to terrify students, but to make them credible to one another when risk arises. Adolescents listen to peers who sound informed, not to adults who sound alarmed. Schools that host on-site clinics or partnerships with community providers shorten the distance between recognition and assistance. Technology presents mixed effects. Algorithms can extend access to counterfeit drugs and gambling with speed and concealment. The same infrastructure can extend access to telemedicine, peer support, relapse alerts, and appointment scheduling. The design question is not whether technology is good or bad, but whether its incentives produce safety. Applications that connect users to same-day appointments, pharmacies, housing navigators, and legal aid reduce friction. Systems that flag high-risk combinations in electronic records prevent predictable harm. Privacy protections must be maintained with consented data sharing that allows care teams to coordinate without repeating intake every time a person crosses a clinic threshold. Cultural narratives influence what people attempt. Communities that celebrate only abstinence miss opportunities to stabilize those who are not ready for abstinence or for whom it is not immediately safe. Communities that celebrate only survival miss the possibility of thriving that follows stabilization. Balanced narratives acknowledge that success includes months on medication without hospitalization, a certificate earned, a lease signed, a reunification completed, and a year without a funeral among close friends. These milestones accumulate into ordinary life, which is the true rival of addiction, boredom that does not frighten, routine that does not oppress, and relationships that do not require performance. International comparisons suggest that design choices matter more than cultural stereotypes. Jurisdictions that emphasize access to medications, harm reduction, and housing first report fewer deaths, infections, and arrests even when supply remains volatile. Jurisdictions that emphasize punitive responses without treatment report persistent problems despite visible enforcement. There is no country without addiction because there is no human group without pain and appetite. There are countries with fewer funerals. Those countries measure what matters, invest where measurement points, and sustain policy across election cycles. Measurement disciplines rhetoric. Dashboards that track access, retention, mortality, infections, housing stability, employment, school attendance, and family reunification prevent drift. Disaggregation by age, gender, race, and geography reveals where systems underserve. Risk adjustment prevents clinics caring for the sickest patients from being punished for the acuity they accept. Measurement without rapid correction is theater. Rapid correction without measurement is guesswork. Together, they form the routine by which a human condition framework becomes ordinary governance. The ethics of care shift under this view. Withholding medications as punishment becomes indefensible when the aim is survival and stability. Zero-tolerance policies that expel patients after a lapse give the lapse more power than it deserves. Involuntary holds are used sparingly, with swift transition to voluntary care the moment imminent danger is past. Consent processes are designed to be comprehensible, and privacy protections are maintained while enabling coordinated action. Respect is not sentimental, it is operational. People return to clinics where dignity remains intact during their worst weeks. Special populations need tailored approaches because the human condition expresses itself differently across life stages and circumstances. Adolescents require confidentiality and developmental framing to build trust. Pregnant patients require integrated obstetric and addiction care that avoids punitive reflexes. Older adults require attention to polypharmacy, fall risk, and grief. People exiting incarceration require bridge prescriptions, transportation, and identification documents on the day of release, not a list of phone numbers. People without housing require doors that open without prerequisites. Each design element communicates whether the system understands a human condition or prefers to imagine a compliant patient who rarely exists outside a chart. Language shapes practice and policy. Person-first terms prevent reduction of identity to condition. Descriptions of harm should be accurate without spectacle. Public statements should include addresses and hours, not only opinions. Alerts about supply changes should tell residents what steps reduce risk. Media coverage should avoid images and phrases that harden stigma and should include stories of successful programs and long-term recovery. Public opinion shifts when residents witness routine competence, and public funding follows opinion. A human condition lens asks communications to serve function, not theater. The economic dimension cannot be ignored. Regions that lost industries and did not replace them with living wage work experienced higher vulnerability to drug markets and to despair that fuels demand. Economic development is not a substitute for treatment, but treatment without economic opportunity stalls at the threshold. Apprenticeships, credential programs, and employer partnerships aligned with clinic schedules turn early recovery into durable routines. Transportation grants, childcare support, and flexible work policies are not extras. They are core infrastructure in an economy that expects stability from people who need predictability to deliver it. Housing remains fundamental. Without a door that locks, medication storage is precarious, telehealth privacy is compromised, and nightly safety is uncertain. Housing-first models reduce mortality and emergency utilization. Recovery housing suits others who prefer substance-free environments, provided that oversight prevents exploitation and rules align with evidence rather than ideology. Eviction for relapse pushes people into locations with higher risk. Step-down supports, landlord engagement, and rent assistance maintain gains that clinical care alone cannot maintain. The limits of enforcement are part of the lesson. Enforcement focused on violence and exploitation is necessary. Enforcement aimed at possession for personal use produces little beyond churn. Asset forfeiture regimes that reward low-level seizures distort priorities. Corresponder models that pair clinicians with officers reduce avoidable arrests and connect people to services at moments when motivation is highest. The social contract strengthens when authorities use force proportionately and predictably, while building health systems that handle conditions that are not amenable to handcuffs. Harm reduction is often mischaracterized as permissiveness. In practice, it is maintenance. It keeps people alive long enough for change to become possible. Naloxone distribution, syringe services, supervised consumption, drug checking, and oxygen availability at outreach sites reduce death and disease. These services also create contact points where staff can offer housing, medication starts, and testing. Evidence shows that people using harm reduction often enter treatment sooner because the staff who distribute supplies also distribute trust. When survival is acknowledged as a legitimate goal, deeper goals become reachable. Medication is not a moral compromise. It is a tool that shifts probabilities. In opioid use disorder, buprenorphine and methadone reduce mortality and improve retention. In alcohol use disorder, medications reduce reward or block receptors and, when combined with counseling and social supports, improve function. Programs that present medication as ordinary medicine rather than as an admission of defeat see higher uptake and better outcomes. The human condition frame simplifies the question: what reduces harm and increases stability with the fewest side effects and the greatest durability? Prevention that works belongs to the same family of ideas. Efforts that remove stigma, provide accurate information, and develop emotional and practical skills reduce risk. Early childhood programs that support caregiver mental health and treat parental substance use protect children. Schools that teach sleep hygiene, digital literacy, and decision-making reduce avoidable vulnerability. University programs that focus on bystander skills in overdose, sexual assault prevention, and mental health crises generate peer groups that handle risk without waiting for perfect circumstances. Prevention is not a sermon delivered to the future. It is a set of practices delivered now to people who already need them. The arts and communal rituals play quiet roles by restoring forms of meaning that do not rely on intensity. Group singing, sports leagues, craft circles, gardening projects, and neighborhood cleanups fill time with cooperative activity that creates visible progress. These are not substitutes for clinical care. They are complements that rebuild identity and belonging. An evening spent finishing a cabinet, rehearsing a piece, or planting a community bed leaves behind evidence that the day occurred. Addiction compresses time into cycles. Activity that leaves artifacts stretches time back out. Systems improve when governance becomes routine. Interagency boards that include health, housing, justice, education, labor, philanthropy, and community organizations can align policy and budget. Public dashboards that update on a schedule create transparency. Annual equity reviews force correction where services lag. Contracting that ties a portion of payment to retention, mortality reduction, and housing stability keeps attention on outcomes that matter. Staff training that includes history and bias reduces unintentional harm. Governance is the background hum that frees clinics to focus on care rather than on improvisation. Counterarguments sometimes claim that a human condition framing weakens accountability or ignores drug pharmacology. In practice, it produces the opposite. It assigns accountability to every level at which influence exists. Individuals are accountable for behavior and for participation in plans crafted with them. Clinicians are accountable for using evidence-based methods and for maintaining access. Agencies are accountable for coordination, staffing, and measurement. Legislatures are accountable for aligning budgets with outcomes. Pharmacology is addressed where it belongs in clinical protocols, procurement, and alerts, while the broader system addresses the reasons pharmacology mattered in the first place. The reframing also clarifies success. Success is not a moral identity. It is a pattern of days. The pattern includes medication taken as prescribed, appointments kept, meals and sleep regular, employment or study maintained, conflicts handled without violence, and repairs made after harm. It includes months without hospitalization, infections prevented or treated, and family routines that hold through stress. It includes grief handled without collapse and celebration handled without escalation. Success is ordinary life resumed and protected, not perfect life achieved. Addiction will persist because pain and appetite will persist. The task is to reduce unnecessary suffering and prevent avoidable death while building the kind of ordinary life that competes with compulsion. That work is possible. It requires humility about limits, precision about methods, persistence in the face of ambivalence, and budgets that match rhetoric. It requires replacing debates that paint program logos on moral positions with plans that put people in rooms, doses in hands, roofs over heads, and hours on schedules. It is less dramatic than a campaign and more durable than a slogan. By seeing addiction as a human condition, the argument shifts from punishment versus leniency to competence versus drift. Competence looks like clinics that start medication the day help is requested, hospitals that treat infections fully and hand patients directly to community teams, courts that distinguish violence from illness, employers that retain talent with structured support, schools that teach practical skills, and neighborhoods where overdose response is taught as readily as CPR. Drift looks like press conferences that repeat old promises while ambulances answer the same addresses. The difference is visible in how many funerals occur and how many leases and diplomas are issued. The final implication concerns hope. Hope in this context is not optimism about substances disappearing or about perfection suddenly appearing in human behavior. Hope is confidence that systems can be arranged to reduce death and increase stability at scale. That confidence is justified wherever metrics improve after design changes. When naloxone saturation increases and deaths decrease, when same-day starts expand and retention improves, when housing stock grows and emergency utilization drops, hope ceases to be an idea and becomes a measurement. A human condition framework provides the discipline to build such evidence and the patience to sustain it. In future chapters of public discussion, demands will arise for immediate, dramatic answers. The steadier answer remains the same. Measure what matters, fund what works, make help immediate, and protect dignity. The rest follows from repetition. The human condition does not change quickly. Systems can. Repetition at scale, of helpful routines, of invite and welcome policies, of careful language, of cooperation across agencies, builds a culture in which addiction is neither denied nor sensationalized. It is addressed as part of ordinary civic maintenance. The record of the past century is clear. Attempts to control substances without attention to people failed. Attempts to treat people without attention to housing, work, and family support also failed. Attempts to combine health, housing, harm reduction, employment, and fair enforcement produced better results. These are not ideology-driven claims. They are observations that can be checked wherever jurisdictions publish dashboards. A community that wants fewer deaths and more stability can obtain them by arranging itself to provide what the human condition requires: safety, connection, purpose, and fairness backed by practical support. Addiction remains a serious subject and deserves serious methods. The work will sometimes be slow and will rarely produce headlines. It will often look like forms completed properly, referrals kept, medications refilled on time, wounds cleaned, arguments de-escalated, and hours spent in steady employment or study. It will look like small apartments with reliable locks and calendars with appointments that are attended. It will look like grandparents at school events, infants rooming in with mothers on stable treatment, and workers who disclose a risk and receive structured help rather than dismissal. It will look like a map of a city where overdoses have declined not by chance but by construction. A book that insists addiction is a human condition ends by asking institutions to behave as if that were true. The request is not that every person with addiction succeed immediately or that every program never fail. The request is that system stop asking drugs to do the explaining that only human context can do, and stop asking punishment to do the healing that only connection and structure can accomplish. The work is plain. Keep people alive, stabilize bodies and minds, restore roles, and defend ordinary life from the narrowing effect of compulsion. That is the task. It is difficult. It is also feasible, and it is the measure against which public will can be judged.